So working with the Brahma Viharas, there's a book by Sharon Salzberg that came out quite a while ago entitled Loving Kindness. It's quite good. There probably are other books, but I don't know them off the top of my head. I could try and do some research and see if I can come up with some books. I have some friends who teach Brahma Vihara, metta, compassion, appreciative joy, equanimity. Teach these practices and see if they have books that they can recommend. If so, I'll send an email to the group with what I find. But I thought I could talk about Brahma Vihara practice this morning. So, the Brahma Viharas occur in maybe 20 or 30 suttas. Brahma Vihara. Brahma is the gods and Vihara is a place to live. So if you want to live with the gods, you do these practices. So, and the most famous way to do the practice is what's given in the Metta Sutta, which I read a couple nights ago, right? But that only occurs, well, the sutta occurs twice. But the description of practicing the Brahma Viharas that's somewhat different occurs, like I say, 20 or 30 times. The way that it's usually given, with one's heart filled with loving kindness, one dwells suffusing one quarter, the second, the third, the fourth. Thus one dwells suffusing the whole world, upwards, downwards, across, everywhere, always with a heart filled with loving kindness, abundant, unbounded, without hate or ill will, to all as to oneself. Okay? So the sutta way of doing metta practice is that one dwells, one lives, one remains in suffusing the whole world with a heart of loving kindness. With a heart filled with loving kindness, one suffuses, it says, one quarter. So the east, the west, the north, the south, above, below, and all around. So there's no phrases, there's no visualization really. It's just generate some metta in your heart and send it out to the directions. Maybe a bit more challenging way to do it than working with the phrases. The phrases come from the Visuddhimagga, and for many people they seem to be a useful way of working. Standard phrases for doing metta, usually people are recommended to have four phrases, and you do them for yourself and you do them for others. May I be happy, may I be healthy, may I be peaceful, may I be liberated. May you be happy, may you be healthy, may you be peaceful, may you be liberated. The idea is to make phrases that speak to you. If the may I or may you seems problematic, then you possibly could choose some other phrase. It's really nice if I'm happy. It's really nice if I'm healthy. Okay, so we could try something like that. It's really nice if you're happy. It's really nice if you're healthy. And that way there's no sense of trying to make something happen. It's just getting in touch with the fact, yeah, it's pretty cool when I'm happy and everyone I know is happy and the whole world is happy. And then there's the way I've been doing metta in the evenings with the guided metta, the guided visualizations. So if you're an auditory person, if you primarily interact with the world through sounds or music or something like that, then the phrases may be the way that really appeals to you. If your primary way of working with the world is more visual, then maybe the visualizations that I'm doing in the evening will seem like something that works for you. The visualizations do tend to overcome the may I or may you, because you're, well, projecting the sun from your heart, the light and warmth out there. Now, The idea behind the metta practice isn't that you're going to go out and fix the world by, you know, you wish that things be different for people and therefore they become different. I mean, that's great if that happens, all right? Unfortunately, most of us don't seem to have that sort of power. The primary effect of metta is on you. By you wishing this, feeling this, getting in touch with this, it has an impact on you. And so you can do this practice and not worry, are you doing it right because you wished your friend to be happy and they weren't happy? Okay. If you wish them to be happy and you're more concerned with their welfare, then it's working correctly. So the major impact is on you. Now, it might have impact on them. It might have impact because you're in a better place, and therefore when you're around them, you're a more loving person, and it has an impact on them. And maybe it has some impact through extrasensory perception, telepathy, I don't know. You know, but it will definitely have an impact on you. So that's why these practices are very important. Now, for the one that's given in the suttas, there's a simile. Just as a mighty trumpeter were with little difficulty to make a proclamation to the four quarters, so by this meditation, by the liberation of the heart through loving kindness, one leaves nothing untouched, nothing unaffected in the whole of the world. Okay, so a mighty trumpeter. Now you're probably picturing a metal trumpet, right? Well, no, it's a conch shell, right? A trumpet at the time of the Buddha was a shell that they would blow through. And then they could blow warnings and signals and things like that. And so just like you could blow through a trumpet and be heard in far away, in the same way you send your metta to those who are far away and everybody in between. So this is the first of the Brahmaviharas. It's spoken of as having near enemy and far enemy. The far enemy is hatred. And the near enemy is, well, it's usually given as affection. There's some degree of clinging or ownership there. So you send metta to someone that you love because, well, yeah, if I love them, then they'll love me back or something like that. Okay? But real metta is unconditional. It's like I'm loving you just because you're a person, not because I get something out of it. And then the second of the Brahmaviharas is compassion, karuna in Pali. And it's given exactly the same. With a heart filled with compassion, one sends it to the east, the west, the north, the south, above, below, all around. Unlimited, unbounded. Thus one dwells, suffusing the whole world, upwards, downwards, across, everywhere, always with a heart filled with compassion. Compassion is basically an attitude of love in the face of dukkha. If you encounter some suffering out there in the world, and you have a loving heart, you do what you can to alleviate that suffering, to alleviate that dukkha. Now, sometimes it may be that you definitely have a loving heart and you encounter dukkha that's out there and you do the best you can and it doesn't work. There's still dukkha there. Well, you just have to let it go. One of the things that's important is not being attached to results. You do the right thing. You do the best you can. And if it works, great. And if it doesn't work, well, you did the best you could. And this is just the way things are. So part of the near enemy of compassion is pity, which can take the form of, oh, let me help you so I won't have people suffering in my environment. So it's more about me. Or, oh, let me help you because If I help you, then I'll feel good about myself, or something like that. But also, it can be, oh, let me help you, and you better be helped, because, and this also becomes the near enemy. So you're helping. What? Yeah, you better be grateful that I helped you, or anything like this. So all of this develops into the near enemy. But the true compassion is you're just responding to some dukkha that you find out there in the world and doing what you can to alleviate it. And if you succeed, great. And if you don't, well, that's just the way the world is. The far enemy of compassion, obviously, is cruelty. There are phrases, or a phrase, given in the Visuddhimagga, and it's pretty simple. May I be free of dukkha, or may you be free of dukkha. The idea is that you pick people, yourself and others, and it recommends you start with someone you know who is suffering, someone who's ill, perhaps. And you just say to them, may you be free of, and if it's something specific, may you be free of your illness. And if it's more general, may you be free of dukkha. And then you do it for yourself, and then you do it for others. But you start with someone you know is experiencing dukkha, because probably it's easier to get the feeling going. If you don't like the may I part, you could do a visualization. The best visualization I've ever come across for doing compassion practice is a vacuum cleaner. All right, so you got this big vacuum cleaner, and you're going and you find somebody with some dukkha, and you and you're going around, and you're just thinking about people and their dukkha and sucking it up into the vacuum cleaner. Okay, so you can try that as a visualization.
I wish I could buy that.
Yeah, to have it in real life would be really, really good. There's a Tibetan practice known as Tonglen, which actually works in much the same way. I would recommend that you study Tonglen with some Tibetan teacher, but basically the idea is that as you breathe in, you breathe in the ills of the world for a specific person or the refugees or just all of the ills of the world. You take them into your heart, and then, very important, you transform them, right, into flowers or healing energy or soothing light. Anyhow, you take them in, you do this act of transformation, and then you exhale these flowers or nice energy or whatever back out to the ones who are suffering. But it's best, as I say, if you learn this from someone who can give you more detailed instruction other than what I just gave you. But it's a very, very powerful practice. The third of the Brahmaviharas is mudita. You see it translated as sympathetic joy. The first time I ever heard the phrase sympathetic joy, it was like, what? I mean, that had as little meaning to me as mudita. And then somebody said empathetic joy and explained that it was rejoicing at the good fortune of others. We have the word for the far enemy, envy. Someone else is having good fortune and you're envious. Why them? Why not me? Right? But in English, there's no word that corresponds to mudita. I don't think you have one in Swedish either, do you? You're happy because somebody else is happy?
Med kärlek, but we don't usually use it.
Right.
Almost compersion. It's a new word.
Yeah? Oh, okay.
It's used within the polygamy community.
Uh-huh.
For when someone that you're in love with falls in love with someone else.
Right.
And you feel the love for...
Right. There is that word in English as well, but nobody knows it.
What was the word?
In compersion.
Uh-huh.
It's not compassion, but compersion.
Yeah. It's very similar in English. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's an unknown word, and it's recently been invented. So the way I like to translate mudita is appreciative joy. Because actually what's being referred to is that whenever there's good fortune, whether it's for someone else or it's for yourself, you appreciate it. Remember, one does these to all as to oneself. Okay, so once again, with a heart filled with mudita, one sends out this rejoicing to the east, the west, the north, the south, above, below, all around. Okay, and this practice, as I said, the far enemy is envy. The near enemy is identification, right? So Sweden wins the gold medal in the Olympics in ice hockey. And all of you are really excited. Well, except for the ones who come from some other country, right? And you're feeling joy, but this isn't mudita because you've identified with these guys that you don't even know that are playing a children's game, right? And making millions of dollars when they come to America and Canada and play for the NHL, right? So it's not mudita, right? Because of your identification there.
Have you seen Football for Buddha?
No.
It's they play in Bhutan.
Oh, yes, I have seen that movie.
So whenever the other team is making goal, the opposite team is...
Yeah, right. So that's very much mudita. If you can watch the finals of the ice hockey in the Olympics and Sweden loses to, well, yeah, we won't say, and you're still happy for the people that are following that team, yeah, then it's mudita. You probably don't remember when Canada won the ice hockey gold over the United States. No, you don't remember that because Sweden got eliminated in the semifinals there. But I was teaching a retreat at Cloud Mountain in southern Washington State, and I had, I think it was about 5 people from Canada on the retreat. And, of course, each one of them, as they came to their interview, wanted to know, what happened? What happened? So, but for me, I actually could be very happy for Canada because it's a really important thing in Canada. In the United States, you know, most people don't even know what ice hockey is. You know, it's all about the NFL or baseball or maybe basketball. And so, yeah, there was a lot more rejoicing in the world if Canada won than if the United States had won. And so I was quite happy that Canada won. So it was mudita. There wasn't an identification there. The example that Ayakema used, your child comes home from school and has really good marks, and you are really happy. And then the neighbor's child comes home from school and has even better marks. Are you even happier because they have better? Well, probably not. Right, so there was some identification there, right? So, yeah, it's this pure joy. You're happy because other people are happy. And it's really a shame that this concept just is almost unknown in the West. Because if you can practice mudita, right, then whenever there's joy in the world, you can be happy as well. You don't have to wait for happiness to come to you, right? You might be in a neutral mood, but you hear about happiness someplace else, and you can be happy because of that. So practicing this opens you up to far more happiness. The Suttimagga gives one phrase again for practicing mudita, and the phrase is, may your good fortune continue and increase. And they recommend that you start with someone that you know is having some good fortune. So you might think of your friend whose life seems, yeah, like it's going really well. And then you can say, may your good fortune continue and may it increase. And then you do it for yourself. May my good fortune continue and may it increase. So again, it's got the may there. For those who aren't interested in the may, you might have to find some different phrase or so.
Just thought about this newspaper. I think it's only a web paper that only shows happy news.
Yes, right.
So it's,
yeah, Yeah, it's somebody turned me onto the paper just recently. Yeah, yeah, I've forgotten what it's called.
Yeah,
yeah, right. Yeah, quite a contrast from the other. But if you need to practice mudita, it's a go-to place. Yeah. There's lots of stuff you can be happy about there.
I hardly have a problem surviving. Yeah. Not because of lack of good news, because we indulge in values.
Right. So I don't have a major appliance to use as a visualization. When I'm doing it as a visualization, I think about my friend who's having some good fortune. And it's like I see some dancing, you know, some flowers and some dancing and so forth. Yeah, this is great. So it's not so much sending it out as I'm happy that they're happy. And so there's, this is good stuff, you know. So that's usually what I work with when I'm working with an image. And then the last one is equanimity, upekkha. And again, one's with a heart filled with equanimity, one sits effusing the east, the west, the north, the south, above, below, and all around. Now this is a little bit more difficult. The far enemy of equanimity is being upset, being freaked out, panic, overreacting. In America, sometimes if a sports team wins the championship, people go on a riot, basically, and, you know, burn cars and trash doors. And I mean, this is really not equanimity at all. This is about as far away as you can get, even though it's something positive. The near enemy is apathy, just not caring. When I was at university, the students organized a meeting because they felt that there was just too much apathy. People at the university didn't care. But nobody came to the meeting. So, upekkha means that you don't get upset, but you're fully engaged. You fully care. Right? So, apathy, you don't get upset. But that's because you're not engaged. You just don't care. But with upekkha, you're really fully present with what's going on, but it doesn't freak you out. If it's negative, there's no tendency to panic. And if it's positive, yeah, you're happy, but you don't become over-exuberant or anything like that. Okay? So, there are various phrases that I've heard for doing upekkha practice. And I actually did hear a good one time, but I forgot it, unfortunately. The ones that I've heard are something like, "You are the owner of your karma. My wishes cannot make things any different from you." Which is true, but it's a very unsatisfying phrase. Another phrase I've heard is, "Things are as they are." Which is true. I mean, but again, not very satisfying at all. So, there was a time I was at the Forest Refuge, and I actually spent 10 weeks doing Brahma-Vihara practice. I did 6 weeks of metta, and then I did 2 weeks on each of the others. Or, no, 4 weeks of metta and 2 weeks on each of the others, I guess. And for the equanimity, I mean, for the metta, I could just get the feeling of metta going and send it out, you know. And for the compassion, I could think about places in the world where there was a lot of dukkha and wish that it be alleviated. I could think of my friends who were having dukkha and wish that things were better for them. Since I was at the Forest Refuge, there really wasn't a lot of dukkha around personally. That was kind of nice. And then for mudita, I could think of my friends who, yeah, things were going really well, and I could really appreciate that and be happy that they were having such a good life, and then, you know, spread that around and hope that everybody in the world, yeah, that was appreciating any good fortune that they had. But then when it came to upekkha, it's like, how do I send equanimity? Am I even supposed to send equanimity out? All of these are about cultivating my heart. So when I'm doing mudita, it's like I'm cultivating the fact that I can be happy when someone else is happy. So it was more like, what I need to do is really reflect on what's going on with my friends, with people I know, with the whole world, and see, can whatever it is, my mind remain in this stable, balanced place. The word upekkha has this sense of gazing upon, right? So you're actually looking at what's there. You're not looking away, but you're not getting out of balance. And it was actually a difficult practice to figure out how to do it. The phrases didn't work at all. You know, I asked the teachers, what are the phrases? And they told me various phrases, and it was like, no, these phrases don't work. And I couldn't think of any visualization that seemed to help. And all that I could really do was pick a direction and just think about what's happening east of here. Right, and so kind of wide, that would encompass the Ukraine, I suppose. And so can I think about what's going on there and just still keep an even-mindedness? And even though I worked with this for 2 weeks and found it beneficial, I never felt like I really had it in a way that was something that really worked well for me. Yeah, going into the fourth jhana generates a feeling of equanimity, and so coming out of it, there was a very equanimous feeling. But how was I to relate that feeling to everybody in the world? And that was the tricky bit. And so I did indeed try that. That feeling was there, and yeah, I could send it out, but I could also sort of remember what that feeling felt like, and I didn't even have to generate the fourth jhana. So I never was really satisfied with the way of practicing with it.
I'm just thinking about the soda pie. If you really get into the soda pie and you get into the economic in yourself, it is actually
It's going all over. Yeah, but I never felt I had as good a handle on it as the other three.
I'm thinking, could you see this as not as four separate states, but more like a cause and effect chain of things, that you start out with the metta, a realization of us being similar.
Mm-hmm.
And from that, there will be the mudita and the karuna, and as you get to the soda pie,
yeah,
and you watch the mudita and the karuna, you realize that this will also pass, the joy will arise and it will vanish, mm-hmm. The pain will arise and it will vanish, and since since we see that we don't attach to the mudita, mm-hmm. and the karuna, so it's not as much as something being sent out, more of a calibrating of the mudita and karuna.
Yeah, yeah. I often think of it as a diamond. And there's metta at the top, and this is an attitude, right, that I'm trying to develop, this loving attitude. And then I go out into the world and I encounter dukkha, and I react with compassion. Or I go out into the world and I encounter joy, and I rejoice with that. And all of it is done with a foundation of upekkha, an even-mindedness there. Yeah, so it as you say, these are really four aspects of the same thing. And it's four aspects of the fact that we're all not separate. We're all really interconnected in many many ways, some of which are obvious and some of which are not so obvious. And our response to connecting with the interconnectedness, and sometimes it's compassion and sometimes it's mudita. And all along, hopefully, it's with a really open heart and, yeah, working for the welfare of all.
The song, K Sera, Sera is coming up.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Yes, for equanimity practice, the same song came up for me when they told me things are as they are. It was like, yeah, okay, I know that song. I don't want it in my head at this retreat. Yeah. What? Oh, it came immediately to me, yeah. But I managed not to keep it coming and coming and coming. So.
So where do we go for a really good Brahma Vihara retreat?
Okay, so where do you go for a really good Brahma Vihara retreat? I have a friend named Jill Shepherd. Some of you might have encountered her. She was teaching with Joseph last year in Denmark. And if you've been to IMS... she was the emergency contact person there. She's now teaching, and she's in the current teacher training program at Spirit Rock, which graduates, I think in a year from now. I was going to suggest that you invite her. She's been specializing in teaching Brahma Vihara practice. She's teaching in Australia and New Zealand, and occasionally in the United States. She teaches retreats often on the weekend, so she'll do one day or 2 days. But I think it would probably be really good if you were to invite her to come for 5 nights, 6 days. So you would have the day that you started, and then you would have 1 day for each of the Brahma Viharas, and then the closing day. So I will be happy to give her email address to Marie and Stefan and Bodil, and you can invite her. She teaches in Australia, and she teaches in the U.S., but sometimes she comes via London, where her sister is. And so sometime when she's coming from Australia to Massachusetts, and she's coming this way, you might be able to get her to stop off, and it wouldn't be paying for her to fly all the way from Australia and back, or something like that. But yeah, you could probably set something up for, I don't know if her schedule's free for next year or the year after. But
you don't know her schedule.
I don't know it right off. But I do know that, yeah, she's got stuff planned into next year. But
you're not coming here 2017.
I'm not coming in 17, but maybe you could get her to come in 17. And this far in advance, that would be good. And if you happen to be someplace where, you know, she's teaching, which mostly is in Australia, New Zealand, and the United States, if you happen to be in one of those places, maybe you can catch a retreat with her. So she's quite good. I've been very impressed with, you know, not only the depth of her teaching, but the depth of her practice. She's got some of the deepest practice of anyone that I know, really dedicated to the path. And she's very clear. And, yeah, really quite good with the Brahma Viharas. So that would be, yeah, one thing that I would recommend. The person most known for teaching Brahma Vihara practice is Sharon Salzberg, but I don't think she comes to Europe anymore. She's teaching in the U.S. primarily, so you'd have to go there. No one else really comes to mind.
I think she used to go to Ireland.
Oh, okay. Okay, so, yeah, you can plug her name into the internet, I'm sure, and find her schedule. So if she goes to Ireland, that's not terribly far away. You can fly on Ryanair. There are other people that do teach the Brahma Viharas, but those are the two that I know the most about. Steve Smith also teaches them, but I don't know if he ever comes to Europe or not.
Anushka Fernandopoul.
What?
Anushka Fernandopoul.
Yes, Anushka. Does she come to Europe?
She was here in May.
Ah, okay.
Yes, for one lecture.
Aha. Uh-huh. Yeah, so you could invite her as well to teach Brahma Viharas. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there are people out there. Yes. You need to get the invitations out and...
She had a relative here, maybe it was in Sweden or Norway, so she had come to visit her.
Aha.
And then she came to Sweden for a week.
Aha, right.
Bodhi took very much care of her.
Yeah, good, good. Yeah, I know Anuska because she lived in the Bay Area. She used to come to my weekly sitting group for a while. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So those are the teachers I know that, you know, teach Brahmavihara practice that I could recommend. Yeah. As for books, as I said, I'll have to check with Jill and some other people and see if they have recommendations. Because I'm just really not sure what's out there. So, we've got about 20 minutes for questions.
I didn't get the near enemy for mudita.
The near enemy for mudita is when there's identification. You're rejoicing, but you're rejoicing because it's like it's happening to me. So when Sweden wins the gold medal in hockey, you're rejoicing, but it's because you've identified with Sweden.
Okay.
Right? Or, you know, your child comes home with good marks and you're rejoicing. It's because it's my child. Mm-hmm. Right? But if the neighbor's child comes home with good marks and you're really happy, that's probably pure mudita.
Near enemy for upeka?
Oh, for upeka, the near enemy and far enemy. The far enemy is getting upset. The near enemy is apathy.
Okay.
Right. Not caring.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Like indifference.
Apathy. Yeah, indifference. Yeah.
Apathisk.
You know, sometimes when there are many, many beggars in Stockholm.
Yes, I've seen. Yeah, my friend explained to me what was happening. Yeah.
And, you know, it's, I think to feel upeka is to take in the suffering of another and still, and be with that suffering and just feel it, but not reacting with grief or, oh, it's so horrible. You know, so many times I pass by and I feel the pain, but I don't react. Sometimes I don't give anything, you know,
mm-hmm.
just go by, but
yeah.
I feel the pain.
Right.
I think that's also
the good. Yeah, it's a very good practice to do that.
Feel the pain of others, but don't upset.
Yeah, don't get freaked out by it.
And don't feel guilty, because many, many people, the reaction is guilt.
Yeah.
And then the mind starts to create stories about why I shouldn't have guilt, because they are actually rich, they come from a, this, and so the mind
starts... The mind starts making stories.
To not have the feeling of guilt, because it's not such a nice feeling.
Yeah. One of the things I used to do with my friend, he lived in Berkeley, California, and we would go to eat dinner somewhere near Telegraph Avenue. And Telegraph Avenue is a very interesting avenue. You can see everything on Telegraph Avenue. It used to have great bookstores, but they don't have bookstores anymore. It still has a very good used bookstores, a couple of used bookstores. It's right near the university, so you see university students. But there are also homeless people, and there are a lot of other shops, so you see just people from Berkeley and so forth. So we would go eat there, and then we would take our leftovers, and we would just walk up and down the street. And when a homeless person asked us for money, we would say, well, we don't have money. We have leftover food. Do you want it? And sometimes they were really, really appreciative of that. And when people would ask us for money, we would engage them to at least say, sorry, no money, have a good life, or, you know, we'd actually speak with them just to...
Exactly,
to acknowledge it.
Yeah.
And it's a great place. When I would go to the bookstores there, yeah, I'd wind up parking my car far away because, no parking around there. And then as I'm walking down the street, I'm just doing metta for everybody I'm encountering. And it's just this huge number, huge variety of people. And it was a really interesting thing to do, to be in a place where, all sorts of things are happening. And just practicing metta for everyone that I saw. Yeah.
I felt it was horrible. Homeless people.
Yeah, we didn't. When I was in 1979, 80, 81, I took a 3-year trip around the world. And when I left San Francisco, there were no homeless people. And I remember being in Kathmandu and seeing people sleeping in doorways, and it was like, this is horrible. And then I went back to America, and by then Ronald Reagan was president, and there were people sleeping in doorways in San Francisco. Yeah, it's a problem that has not been addressed at all.
I was just thinking when we talked about teachers, if I may ask something more personal, do you have any teacher that you go to now regular or like following or mm-hmm. whatever you would say? I know Pao Auk is a teacher you went to a couple of times. Is
right.
there any other teacher for yeah. the other practice that you do?
Yes, I try.
Also, if there is some other jhana teachers except you and Pao Auk that you know about.
Yeah. Okay. So the teachers I like to study with, Joseph Goldstein. I try and go to the Forest Refuge when he's teaching there. He's very good. I learn from him every time. You know, he's just so brilliant. He's been totally dedicated to this path for... 50 years. he gives brilliant Dharma talks, and he's such a great technician in terms of just taking your practice and saying, why don't you try this? Why don't you try that? So, highly recommended. I like Stephen and Martine Batchelor. They live in the south of France near Bordeaux, mm-hmm. and they teach at Gaia House, and they teach at other places as well. I think they come to Scandinavia from time to time.
Martina was in Finland.
Right.
In the spring. Mm-hmm. And comes to Sweden in October.
Right. Yeah, so I really like both of them. I like Stephen for his scholarship. You know, he's someone who's doing scholarship that I can really appreciate. And so we've gotten to know each other and be friends. And yeah, so we you know, argue about it. No, it means this, and so forth. In a very friendly way, it is great. And Martine, yeah, she's quite brilliant as well. She's really good with various ways of doing practice, more from her Zen background, but I think still very, very helpful. There's a couple named Kittisaro and Tanisara. They were monk and nun with Ajahn Sumedho at Amravati Monastery in England. And back, now maybe it's close to 20 years ago, they left the monastery and got married. They live in South Africa now. In addition to teaching the Dharma, they run an AIDS project. South Africa has huge problems with AIDS, and so they're working with that. But they're also brilliant teachers. He gives some of the best Dharma talks I've ever heard. He's just so brilliant. Kittisaro.
Kittisaro.
And his wife, Tanisara. Okay. And their orientation now is a bit more Mahayana, and it has more devotion in it. But I still very much enjoy sitting with them because they've got such good hearts. And, yeah, they're really, really dedicated to the path. They're manifesting what it means to be a bodhisattva in a way unlike many other people. So those are people I try and sit with every chance that I get. I don't know that I would ever sit with Pao Auk again. I might. But he doesn't seem to be teaching much anymore. So it's not so much an option.
He just say 1, 2, 3 hour.
Yeah. Right. So those are people that I've sat with, you know, recently and really liked. I sat with Bhikkhu Anālayo. He's a scholar, but he's also a very good teacher. He's taught at IMS, and he teaches at Berry Center for Buddhist Studies. And he's a scholar of the Satipatthana Sutta, and he has a set of practices that he teaches you that are built on the practices found in both the Chinese version and the Pali version. So it's not all of the practices of the Satipatthana Sutta. But it's quite interesting, and he has a different way of doing a body scan. And, yeah, I like sitting with him. Maybe the best thing about sitting with him, he comes in for the morning talk, I don't know, 8:30, and he sits down and he gives the talk and gives you the instructions and the guided meditation. And then, you know, you can go do walking meditation. He's just sitting there. You come back, he's just sitting there. And he sits there until it's time for lunch. And then in the afternoon, he comes in and he sits down, you know, 1 p.m. and he sits there till the evening talk because he's not eating supper, right? And you walk into the room and it has such a degree of concentration in it that it's unbelievable. I don't know how he does that, okay? But the best jhanas I've had in the last several years was when I was on retreat with him. You know, you just walk in and he's got the concentration turned up to 11. It's just really quite nice. So very, very good to practice with him.
What was his name?
Analayo. A-N-A-L-A-Y-O. Yeah?
Was he a monk?
He's a monk. He lives in Hamburg. I think 3 days a week he takes care of his elderly parents, and 4 days a week he's on retreat. And he's a professor at the University of Hamburg. And he travels around a good bit. Speaks excellent English. So, yeah, he's quite...
Germany?
Hamburg, Germany. Yeah, not far. Just the other side. Just the other side of the pond. Yeah. So, yeah, he teaches quite a bit in Europe, and he would be someone I would recommend. Yeah.
Very, very clear. So when I read it, I was so, you know, I skipped some parts, and some parts were great. But then I talked to, and I had a feeling that he's very
precise.
Cold. But then I met a woman, and she said, he's such a sweet person.
Yes.
He's just metta and loving kindness. So when I started to read the book again, I read it in a different way because
yeah.
I felt his warmth.
Yeah, yeah, he's
very nice to know that he's very...
Mm-hmm. He's very accessible. And he's going to be starting work on Satipatthana and Metta. He and Sharon Salzberg are teaching together. I don't think it's next year. I think it's the year after. I'm not sure. Yeah, so he'll be doing more in terms of Metta practice at some time in the future.
I'm intrigued by the concept that... people feel concentration in the room.
Yeah.
Because of one person. And as the one skeptic, couldn't that be explained to some extent of, let's say, the placebo effect of this well known person, you know, himself sitting there? And immediately I get wrapped up in this reputation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know how he does it. It may be all placebo, okay? But it works. I mean, as I said, it was the deepest jhanas. Both times I sat with him, it was the deepest jhanas I'd
had. A big sample, of course.
What?
A big sample.
Well, twice. But yeah. And I have sat with a lot of other people, and nobody else does it like that. So, I mean, it was just... and. It was interesting because the first time I sat with him, it was at IMS, so they had, you know, 90 people, and I knew probably a quarter of the people. It was a really interesting group to be with, and so I had all these friends to talk to afterwards, and everybody was going, wow, he had the concentration in that meditation hall really turned up. And, yeah, I mean, this was not just my opinion. There were a lot of people saying that. So how he managed to do it, I have no idea.
Mechanism of perception.
However he did it, it was really good. Okay. And I just don't know how he did it, whether it was magic or it was just, you know, he's up there sitting for so long that we get inspired, or it doesn't matter. It was like, those were really good jhanas.
Can you feel that if you're going for YouTube, if he's talking like this?
No.
Or is it missing?
No, it doesn't come across on YouTube. I'm sorry. YouTube
is... doing jhanas? Is he practicing jhanas?
No.
No.
He's practicing the Satipatthana practices that he gives. Yeah. So there's some degree of concentration, but it's not jhanic concentration.
Is he involved in Goenka tradition also?
Yeah. He is? Yeah, he's a Goenka
assistant teacher.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
For me, this is very strange to understand how could be so many different assistant teachers
and allowed to do different things to like he do.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm very happy to see it's more open.
Yeah, yeah, I am too.
Opening.
Yeah, no, that's very nice.
When you think on a different yana, what is illusion in that sense? I mean, how do you know if it's not illusion?
Yeah, how do you know you're not making it up?
Yeah.
Because when you go home and you try it and it's a lot harder to do, if you were making it up, it would go just as easy every time. Yeah, you're probably the, I don't know, 200th person to ask that exact question. Am I just making this up? Well, in a sense, you're making your mind do this. But if when you come out of it, you feel more concentrated and your insight practice goes more smoothly and you get deeper insights, then who cares if you're making it up, right? If it works. But the real test is that when you go home, you'll find that it's more difficult to do. And if you were just making it up, you ought to be able to make it up the same in any circumstance. So there really is an effect here.
If I'm making it up or if it's an illusion.
Well, if you're making it up or it's an illusion, you ought to be able to make it up or make the illusion happen even when you go home just as easily.
But if it's real, then what's the difference between if it's real or an illusion?
What's the difference between...
If it is an illusion or not, what is the difference?
Well, from a neuroscientific perspective, you can see that my brain is different. All right, so I'm putting myself into a different place. Now, the places that I describe, I say the second jhana, I feel really happy. And they look at my brain and they go, well, you know, this center right here, when it's got a lot of activity, that's when people feel happy. So I do seem to be triggering parts of the brain that are associated with the states to whatever extent they can tell. Not so much the higher jhanas because, yeah, how are you going to know about infinite space in your brain? But happiness and contentment, yeah, they can see that that's going on. And furthermore, it has this effect on the insight practice. And so even if it's an illusion, but it enables your insight practice to work that much better, who cares?
It's the question of...
The question of... asked earlier about other jhanic teachers?
Right. Oh, yes. Okay, so I'll get right back to that. You had another question?
No, I just said, you know, people say, oh, it's just placebo. Like, placebo is something to just...
Yeah.
You know, placebo is fantastic.
Yeah.
Come on, it's like placebo.
Yeah, no side effects and it works. Yeah. Yeah, there's these pills they call no jet lag, all one word. Yeah.
They really work.
They really work. And it's homeopathic, which means it has no active ingredients. But it works. And it, so is it placebo? I don't care. It works. So, yeah, I was able to come to Europe, to England, and start teaching 4 days later. You know, I couldn't do that if it wasn't for the no jet lag.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, other jhana teachers. On my website, if you click on jhanas, and you scroll down, you'll find various interpretations of the jhanas. And in that, I've listed the people I know that are teaching and a little bit about how they understand the jhanas. So under Vasuddhimagga jhanas, I have Pau Auk, obviously, Shaila Catherine, Steve Snyder and Tina Rasmussen. I think that's all I have there. And then I have Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn Brahmawamsa in Perth, Australia. He says he's not teaching Vasuddhimagga jhana. He says he never read the Vasuddhimagga, but yeah, it's Vasuddhimagga jhanas. You got to get a nimitta and all this other stuff. Okay? Other teachers, Christina Fellman at Gaia House will teach jhanas if you do a 3-month course there. You go on self-retreat for 3 months, then she might work with you with the jhanas. Otherwise, she doesn't seem to teach them. Rob Berbea at Gaia House will teach jhanas. Unfortunately, he's quite ill at the moment, so you can send him a lot of karuna. May he be free of his illness. Tanisaru Bhikkhu, Tan Jeff, teaches jhanas. He has less concentration than what I learned from Ayakema because he wants you to do insight practice while you're still in the jhana. So, yeah, you've got to back off quite a ways to do that. I'm saying just, yeah, forget about the jhana. Just start doing your insight practice and let the jhana go. So a little difference there. Rob Berbea is a student of Tanisaru Bhikkhu, so he's more do the insight practice in the jhana. There's Bhante Gunaratna. He's a Sri Lankan monk who lives in West Virginia, and he sometimes teaches jhanas. And again, he wants you to do the practice in the jhana. He's written a book that I actually didn't find very good, and I found out later it was ghostwritten. Somebody else wrote the book, and he just did some editing on it. So, but you can get a sense of what he's teaching maybe if you read that book. And then there's Bhante Vemularamsi, who is near Cape Girardeau, Missouri, and he teaches jhanas in a very light form. You could be washing the dishes and still be in the eighth jhana, according to him. So those are the teachers that I know off the top of my head. There's just not a lot of others around.
But they're listed in your...
They're listed there.
Yeah.
There's a few people I've taught to teach jhanas. There's Jay Michelson, but he and his partner are just adopting a child, so I rather doubt he's going to be teaching many retreats. There's Lucinda Green, who was in Colorado Springs, Colorado. She was a student of Ayakema's. I think she's living in Florida now. And occasionally she teaches jhanas if you're on a retreat with her, and you know, she feels like you've got some facility, she'll teach them, but she doesn't teach jhana retreats. There's Lloyd Burton in Denver, Colorado. And Lloyd and I have taught retreats together, teaching jhanas, but he doesn't teach jhana retreats. There's Kevin Griffith, who is known for teaching 12 steps in Buddhism. And I taught him to teach jhanas, but I don't think he does it very much. So I'm currently working with Mary Aubrey and Brian Lesage to teach them to teach jhanas. So maybe someday they'll be teaching jhanas. So there's a few people around, but there's not much. Oh, there's a man in Los Angeles named Marv Traeger, and he teaches jhanas in the same style as I teach them. I think that's... I don't have all those people listed on there.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any suggestions with regard to falling asleep and waking up in terms of metta? And I tend to wake up with quite a scattered mind.
Yeah. So two suggestions. It's been said that doing metta before going to sleep will help you sleep better. You'll have nicer dreams and so forth. Mm-hmm. So that's one possibility. I was given the practice at Swan Moak I was to be mindful enough to determine whether I fell asleep on an in-breath or an out-breath, whether I woke up on an in-breath or an out-breath. You could do that. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Stay awake all night.
No. I'll give you a hint. When falling asleep, be mindful of falling asleep. Don't try and do mindfulness of breathing. That'll keep you awake all night. So I found that when I was trying to do that practice, I was a bit more alert when I wake up. But I'm not someone that knows much about being alert when they wake up. This does not happen to me very often. So, yeah, very scattered.
Isn't it in the Buddhist teachings as well? If you wake up, just get up.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, don't lie in bed. Yeah. Just go ahead and get up. Is that the bell?
Illusion.
Yeah. No, it's actually good practice. So, enjoy your lunch. Keep the silence. We'll break silence tomorrow morning at breakfast. So, you know, just keep the silence going and keep your practice going. And enjoy your lunch.